Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And Chris Matthews is here, host of Hardball on MSNBC. He has a new book called Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. And Chris happens to be the subject of the lead item on the Drudge Report today. I don't know if he's even aware of it, but atop the conservative search engine is the headline, Chris Matthews Turns on Obama. For this unflattering comparison with the president, with President Kennedy, that Matthews made on MSNBC over the weekend.
There is no Peace Corps. There is no Special Forces. There is no 50-mile hikes. There's no moon program. There's nothing to root for. What are we trying to do in this administration? Why does he want his second term? Would he tell us? What's he going to do in his second term? More of this? Is this it? Is this as good as it gets? Where are we going? Are we going to do something in the second term? He has yet to tell us. He has not said one thing about what he'd do in his second term. He never tells what he's going to do with reforming our health care systems, Medicare, Medicaid, how he's going to reform Social Security. Is he going to deal with long-term debt? How? Is he going to reform the tax system? How? Just tell us. Why are we in this fight with him? Just tell us, Commander, give us our orders and tell us where we're going. Give us the mission. And he hasn't done it. I don't have a sense that he's ever had a meeting. I hear stories that you will not believe. Not a single phone call since the last election. They don't call. He never calls. That's the message. Members of Congress, I keep asking, when did you hear from him last?
Silence.
He doesn't like their company.
Chris Matthews, while being interviewed by MSNBC's Alex Witt, he is here live now with his thoughts on the failure of the Super Committee, Campaign 2012, meetingless Obama, and Jack Kennedy, elusive hero. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. How are you this weekend?
I'm good. Thank you.
I think we're in a good time of year, generally speaking. I'm not sure the political situations is as positive as the time of year.
Yeah, well, we all love Thanksgiving week on a personal level. But did Drudge overstate the headline, Chris Matthews Turns on Obama?
Well, that's Drudge. That's his headline, not mine. Everything I said is, I think, irrefutable, wouldn't you say?
You tell me. You're closer to it than I am.
Well, I think the problem of the need for a positive outlook for a second term is important. I think if you're going to ask someone for a second term as president of the United States, you must give them a very clear preview of coming attractions, to use a movie term. And I think you have to begin to tell them the nature of any entitlement reform. We know it all is necessary. We know that some kind of reduction in the debt is essential. We know all these things have to be. And then, of course, we're always looking for something a little more marvelous, a little more adventurous. Are there any novel things he wants to do in the second term? He certainly pushed through health care. Does he have a plan for the second term in terms of making history? He promised to be a transformative president. I think in that case, you have to tell us what you're going to transform and what you're going to do historically that will be remembered. I think he's very conscious of his place in history, as he should be. But I think he has to give us a portrait of what we're voting for.
Right.
And I think that otherwise it will be a purely negative campaign, by whoever runs for the Republican, and him as well. That would be two negative campaigns.
So that's looking ahead. But even looking back, I was really struck by the beginning of that clip when you said no Peace Corps, no moon program, no 50-mile hikes. Did Kennedy have something that you thought you would see in Barack Obama?
It depends on the way I'm asked the question. I think I could pose this as constructive criticism or negative criticism, but it is criticism. The failure to engage the American people would be when I wrote that piece for Time magazine 2 or 3 weeks ago, it was the five lessons I was asked to do was the five things that President Kennedy could teach President Obama. And one of them is to include participatory politics is everything. Machiavelli taught us 500 years ago, you have to ask people to do things. You have to engage them. Parents are loyal to their kids because of all they do for them. The secretary who serves the boss for 20, 30 years is more loyal to the boss than perhaps the boss is to the secretary. It's all about the nature of engagement. It's human nature. If you give to something, whether you work in a campaign or you serve the military, you fight and risk your life or perhaps give your life for your country, your family's more invested than ever. This is something that Machiavelli figured out is the essential political reality, that if you don't understand, you don't understand politics. Politics is not giving people things and expecting gratitude. It's letting them give you something, letting them invest in you, sharing. When Kennedy was president, every male, every female felt they were part of something. They were part of something that was American and patriotic and big and adventurous. And so they were all given a role. And this is sort of, let me remind you of a phrase that's so critical to our nation state, which is war effort. Now, it doesn't have to be during a war, but the concept of a war effort is everyone does something, whether it's collect scrap metal, collect old newspapers, buy war bonds, do something, work at a war factory, right. A vital industry. Everyone
Bush
has
said
a sense of participation. Oh, that
Bush,
is missing.
Bush said go shopping.
Well, that's a joke. I'm asking, that's not involvement or investment, that's consumption. But I really think that, I know you're being mirthful here, but I think what I'm getting to is the point that real participation is what leads to investment and what leads right. to real patriotic spirit.
And I think
here's my problem with the president. He was not inaugurated in the most spiritually festive moment I think I've been engaged in, where you're sitting on the Washington Mall, and there's thousands of African Americans who generally don't come to the Washington Mall. They live in the city but don't share in its national role. All coming, this city was packed on the mall, and then the president, having just been sworn in, dismissed the crowd and said, go home now, I'll take over. And Kennedy didn't do that.
And I remember when people were comparing Obama to JFK, and maybe it raised the expectations too much, but you remember, Chris, how his speech about no white America or black America, no red America or blue America, one America, got compared to JFK's Ask Not What You Can Do for Your Country. Were you making that comparison?
Yeah, well, that thrilled me, and I think, it thrilled me. And he would speak about our country in a way that was so patriotic, it actually moved me. It moved me. And he also surrounded himself with Ted Kennedy and Caroline Kennedy and Patrick Kennedy and Ted Sorensen and Greg Craig, all these Kennedy people and Kennedy family members. I remember right across the street where I'm now on Nebraska Avenue in Washington at American University, where he had them all there that day. So much identifying, having the last day of the convention out in Denver, an outdoor event, just like Kennedy did in Los Angeles. All these evocations of Kennedy. And back, remember he did that sort of smackdown, to use a modern term, of Clinton by saying, I'm going to be a transformative president like Clinton. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be like one of the greats. And I think he did. The chief reason why he should imitate Kennedy is he promised he would, to do those kinds of grand, inclusive things that really drive a country, move a country.
Chris Matthews, my guest on WNYC. Want to call and talk to Chris Matthews? Doesn't take call on Hardball. You can talk to him here, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post a question for Chris Matthews at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. So to JFK, all those things that you're talking about, the Peace Corps, the Moon Program, the 50-mile hikes, very, very accessible. Like, people can get their minds around them, like you were just saying. And yet your book is called Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Why elusive?
Boy, was he. That's the phrase that Jacqueline Kennedy used in a letter to Theodore Sorensen. She was applauding him for a statement he had made about late President Kennedy in 1985 at an unveiling of his portrait at the National Portrait Gallery. And she said, you've captured him. And she was talking about him, the man. Not the president, but the man. I wrote this book to try to get to what he was like. Jack Kennedy once told Ben Bradley, the journalist, that the reason people read biographies is to answer that question, what's he like or she like? And I wanted to try to get to what he was like at school, what he was like in the Navy as a pal, as a war buddy, what it was like to be in a room with him late at night in the South Pacific with nothing around you except his company. And I was able to do that. And that's I'm still finding him elusive in some regards. His relationship with Jacqueline is very hard to get to. I think I've gotten to his sort of not strange to us, but his relationship to the Catholic Church, his devotion to the Church's rituals like communion and confession and kneeling at bedside before he went to bed, and all those things I'm very connected to. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, having a reputation for womanizing, and how did he put them all together? Well, he just did. And when you tell it to priests or archbishops, I told to one, and they look at you, well, like, what else is new? People are complicated. Almost emotionally connected to his lost sister Kathleen and his lost brother and his lost infant son Patrick, sneaking off to the gravesides and kneeling down in great pain because he was always in tremendous back pain, and doing it very privately, especially the confessional role. It's very private for a Catholic. It's not something mm-hmm. you do. But even when he was using an old term or modern term, messing around, he was living with a weekend with Inga Arvid, the Danish model and movie star that he was going with in the war. He would J. Edgar Hoover was snooping on him, and he was with her when he had been shipped down to Charleston to get away from her, to keep her away from, keep him away from her. They spent the whole weekend of the 4 days together in this hotel, the Fort Sumner Hotel, and only came out basically to go to church. I mean, I, as a Catholic, find that a fascinating sort of look into this guy's complicated sort of St. Augustine view of things, which is, Lord, save me, but not just yet. So I went to those kinds of extremes to really find out who he was, which are of interest to his co-religionists, but also his relationship to other people, his need for company. He never wanted to be alone. Even at night, he would have Dave Powers stay with him until he had Dave turn out the lights at 11 o'clock at night when he'd kneel at his bedside. He would have people come for weekends. He never wanted to be alone or for a long time with any one person, including Jacqueline. He needed to have fresh company. And I traced it back to his youth, and Gene Kennedy helped me with this, his last surviving sibling, that he was always alone as a kid, always sick, very sick, facing the threat of leukemia at one point, and always wanting some company to come to the infirmary or the hospital up in Boston. He was always the sick kid and lonely. And that's why he became a great reader of Churchill, of course, reading him his History of World War I at the age of 14. And the New York Times every day at school at Choate, he would read it and lie in his bed and analyze it. I've got firsthand witnesses to the young sort of autodidact he was. And so I think he is an interesting guy, and I've been trying to plumb the depths of the man.
Chris Matthews, MSNBC Hardball host, talking today's politics and his new book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. And Chris, I don't know if this will surprise you or not, but there is one main thread of phone caller who we're getting. We have 10 lines, and I'd say probably six of them are saying some version of what we're going to let April in Manhattan say to you. April, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. First, I adored Jack Kennedy. My mother kept a campaign button of his for her entire life, and I still have it, although I gave it to an Irish doorman that I really like.
Well, I have someone just gave me a Youth for Kennedy button, one of those old giant buttons.
Wow.
And
the Kennedy,
yeah. And a book
well,
signing event.
My first vote was for Hubert Humphrey, although I was a leftist.
Mine, too. Isn't that interesting?
I was a realist,
1968,
you know?
I was in Peace Corps training in Louisiana, and I thought, actually, as I thought at the time, Nixon would do a better job getting us out of Vietnam because he'd be more ruthless about it. I voted for Humphrey because of civil rights and because I thought his running mate was excellent. Although I questioned his role as VP, but I thought his record on civil rights was exemplary. In fact,
so was LBJ's. But my main point is, you know, he was in totally, entirely different economic situation.
Kennedy.
You know, he had money to put, you know, it's terrible cutting back on NASA. But, you know, we can't afford things because we have too much of a military.
Kennedy governed in good times.
And, you know, he'd made mistakes like the Bay of Pigs. I don't know what you think about the exploded cigar.
You think Chris is idealizing Kennedy too much?
Well, you know,
you have to read the book before you say that. I don't think I do. I think I admire him so much historically because he moved us and made us a better country. And I think he did have Operation Mongoose under Bobby's control going after Castro to try to embarrass him. And the Bay of Pigs was not a moment of great leadership. He should have asked the key question. How many Cuban troops, regular troops, will be there at the beach the first day that the exiles arrive? And all he had to know was that answer, which is 25,000 to meet 1,500 exiles. They were going to be driven off the beach, and it was just something he should have known to ask. And Lemnitz, or the head of the Joint Chiefs, never advised him. And the Alan Dulles and Dick Bissell at CIA had their own purpose, which was to hook him into supporting the invasion with U.S. forces. And he said, "Oh, is that the game you're playing? Well, I'm not going to do it." And I think it was one of the great moments of his presidency when he said to the CIA, "Nice try, guys. Now those guys are going to get killed on that beach and rounded up, most of them. It's because of you. But I'm not going to take U.S. forces into a war with the Soviet Union," which would be what would happen if I went into Cuba.
Chris,
so he did great things by not, many ways, like Eisenhower. Some of his greatest moments as leader was to say no to the military.
April, thank you for your call. The failure of the Super Committee, Chris. Let me play two short clips with a Democrat and a Republican trading blame from Meet the Press yesterday and get your take on what happened. We have John Kyle and John Kerry.
Let's take the areas where we've at least had some agreement in our meetings, put those together, and it adds up to about $640 billion that we could actually save in increased costs or, in some cases, derive some revenue. Our Democratic friends said no to that offer because it didn't raise taxes, and I think it tells you a lot. And that is that in Washington, there's a group of folks that will not cut a dollar unless we also raise taxes.
All right, well, for a deficit. Reduction Committee that is now hung up because we won't do the Bush tax cuts permanently, even though we could have accelerated tax reform by next year. We're here all day. We are ready to do $1.2 trillion, not less than it. That's the law. We're ready to do it if they will give up their insistence on the Bush tax cuts and get this done.
Chris Matthews, I don't know that I've ever seen John Kerry angrier than yesterday on Meet the Press.
Yes, he's not normally a passionate man in politics, and he certainly has gotten to be. He looks like a leader here. Look, this problem is so transparent to all of us. The Republican Party is bound by ideology right now. The Democratic Party is bound by constituency concerns. Neither party wants to hurt itself with its own people. So the Republicans are worried about the tax opposers, and the Democrats are afraid of offending ARP and the older people with regard to Social Security and Medicare reform. And so neither side wants to offend their base. The dangerous thing in American politics is this model we have now, where no one can be defeated by a moderate. You can be defeated in an African-American district by someone younger and to your left. You can be defeated in a conservative white state like Utah by someone younger than you and to your right. But no one faces defeat by being too extreme. You can always win by going to the right if you're a conservative or to the left if you're a liberal. And that model that is very unstable now, it's never going to come to equilibrium because neither side has any political advantage in a deal. And it is so sad. What has to happen is a leader has to put a number on the table, some kind of revenue growth, some kind of entitlement reform, put it on the almost invisibly walk in the room and say, here's the deal, guys, like a puck in a hockey game. Here it is. Here it is, where you know you're going to end up. Let's all agree on it. But somebody has to do that almost with invisible hands because no one wants to say they initiated it, and that's our problem.
You know, many people say Obama was no profile in courage when he failed to embrace the compromise suggestions of his own deficit reduction commission, Simpson-Bowles, and that set up Congress to end in gridlock due to the president's lack of risk-taking or leadership. Fair criticism?
Chris, and at the time I was hesitant to say that because I thought it was a bit right of center, but you know, it was right of him. It was right of Obama. It was around the center, if you look at politics today, which is sort of slightly right of center, maybe, in terms of the country's mood right now. Look, I think it was right. I thought the fact that he had 11 of the 17 was enough. He didn't have the 14 of the 18 at 11, and he had people like Durbin sticking their neck out. Dick Durbin, you would think if he had an ally, it would be him from Illinois, the senator on that committee.
Very liberal senator.
And I have to tell you, my daughter, who's now graduated from Penn, she was on that working and drafting a bit of that. She's only 21. They had a very lean staff. But I was so involved in my daughter, because her generation has a bipartisan group called Youth CYA, Concerned Youth of America. It also has that other meaning of that nickname. But they're very concerned in a bipartisan way about debt and what it's going to do to their generation. So from that perspective, It was a middle-of-the-road solution. It wasn't an Obama solution. But I think anyone who thinks that there was going to be a liberal solution to the budget problem we're facing in the long run is really not focusing on the reality that there is a sort of a rightward tilt to our politics. One thing Tip and Reagan did together, which has been lost, when they cut the deals they did, it was never, and I was Tip's AA at the time, it was not about 50-50. Deals are, everybody thinks deals are 50-50. They're never 50-50. What they were was, after Reagan came into office with that big mandate after Carter lost, was he had the wind at his back, and Tip said, okay, I'm not getting in your way. I will oppose you rhetorically, but I'm not going to obstruct you, because he knew who had won the election. And in 83, right after the 82 pickup of 26 seats by the Democratic side, Reagan knew who had won. And so his solution to Social Security, which he pushed with Tip, was a Democratic solution. It was largely revenue increases, not benefit cuts. So the key to American Democratic-Republican politics is you look at the election returns, and then the next big fiscal deal you cut should reflect those returns. Mm-hmm. But it should be a deal. Now, where the Tea Party gets in the way of this is they basically say no deal, because every deal has to involve some give, not 50-50. They should give something on revenues, and they would have gotten deals.
I think for all the talk about how next year will be a pivotal election for our future and a battle of big ideas. And this was the going commentary on the Sunday talk shows yesterday. Well, this is going to be fought out in the election, campaign next year, which is where it belongs, not in some elite super committee, blah, blah, blah. But I think it could be a very low turnout election.
Yeah.
If it's Romney versus Obama, neither candidate really excites his party's base anymore. And the moderate centrists think both parties are for the birds. So who exactly is going to vote, Chris, next November?
Well, here's my concern, and it gets back to what you heard me say on our weekend program on MS. I am concerned that because Obama doesn't put forward a positive look at what he's going to do in his second term, his only outlet is to go completely negative and try to blame and make Mitt Romney look like a job killer, go after Bain Capital, his record as a private sector guy, and really portray him as one of the bad guys in American economics. Well, that would be a very desultory campaign because obviously the Republicans will put $1 billion out there attacking the economic record of this president. So
right.
You'll have two negatives. And then what you'll have is that thing, Brian, you've seen in campaigns where both sides attack each other, and there's a third person that wins. Now, if there's no third person in this race, you're right, then the winner is the stay-at-home voter who says, hey, you both convinced me that neither one of you are any good,
yeah.
So I think I'll stay home.
Last question.
What a desultory, undemocratic result.
We will see. Last one for the history books. From your book, The Elusive Jack Kennedy, everybody knows he was elected president in 1960, but I'll tell you one of the most interesting parts of your book for me is the section when Kennedy puts his name into nomination for vice president,
yes,
at the 1956 Democratic Convention, and he winds up crossing swords with, of all people, Eleanor Roosevelt. Can you
right.
talk about that convention?
Yes. Eleanor Roosevelt was sort of the flame keeper of the New Deal. Her husband and she had a political relationship as well as a marriage, and she really was the heiress to his reign, if you will. He was almost a king. He was beloved and hated as well. And he had carried on. He carried on until 45 when he died. And then she sort of took over as the keeper of that flame. Truman was there, but she was always there. And then, of course, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, the governor of Illinois, who was probably the most wonderfully oratorical presidential candidate we've ever had, she was his... She was devoted very much to Stevenson winning again in 60 and in 56, of course. She also had this strange sort of attitude about Catholics, which may be old liberal or whatever, but she was suspicious of them as a group. Obviously, Joe McCarthy didn't help. And I guess Irishmen have generally been not exactly reformers in politics. But she just had an attitude about people like Joe Kennedy. And she also she inherited, of course, the rivalry and hatred, if you will, of her husband toward Joe because he was an appeaser. And a sympathizer of the Nazis as they rose to power and began the war in 39. So she had no love for the Kennedy family. Now Jack was never able to crack through that sense that she had that he was his father's son. And she would meet with him. It'd be one of these sort of oil and water meetings where there was just nothing there of love. I don't know about you, Brian. I don't know you at all. But I mean, there's some people that you just can't connect with.
Yeah,
you just can't, and I think it was one of those relationships. And by the way, it continued through 60 when Kennedy sent a spy, in to see her, and the
spy?
Man was Jewish, and it turns out that she said, we wouldn't want a pope in the White House, would we?
Oh.
And he went back and told Kennedy that, and he couldn't believe, well, he did believe it, but it was pretty shocking.
Did it change once he was elected? She was still alive, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it changed. I think that he did go to her funeral up at Hyde Park, but that was sort of a ceremonial
right,
event.
Sure.
I'm not sure there was any
right.
love lost there. He also continued with his kind of rivalry with Adlai, even though Adlai stood up so strongly for America during the Cuban Missile Crisis, rather dramatically and forcefully and heroically he stood up for us in the UN. And yet there was always that sort of, he's not one of us.
One of those things. Chris, how's your time? Can you take one or two more calls?
Sure.
Here is Bob in Rigo Park. You're on WNYC with Chris Matthews. Hi, Bob.
Chris, how you doing? I love your show.
Thank you.
Honesty. My question is this. I voted for Obama. His problem is he doesn't bring people into the floor. He's too isolated. My question is, wouldn't it be a great idea to bring Occupy Wall Street into his actual yard, into the Washington House, sit down, talk, no alcohol and talk about issues, that's keeping everyone an arm.
Well, I wish you could. Sir, Bob, I think you got a great idea if you could find a group of 4 or 5 or even 10 or 20 people that could sit down with him and voice the myriad of concerns. I think that he's been pretty standoffish about Occupy Wall Street. And the most important thing about Occupy Wall Street is it's been its central geography. They've taken their case against Wall Street rather than against the Congress. And these are very interesting geographical things. Remember the March on Washington with Dr. Martin Luther King? It was very important that that march went to the Lincoln Memorial and not to the White House. It's all about where you direct your protest. Mm-hmm. And I think that this one was so smart. In one little regard, the polling synchronized with the Occupy. 86% of the American people believe that Wall Street has too much clout in Congress. And boy, if that is a unifying issue, it isn't people are too rich. It isn't about one specific policy. It's the sense that the people in New York and Wall Street, on both sides politically, are able, through their incredible contributions to these politicians, to have so much influence over legislation.
One more. James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to say to Mr. Matthews that this left obsession with the Kennedys is really, at this point, bordering on almost ridiculous. I mean, the problems that we face as a nation today, first of all, we're not poorer than we were in 1960, so the notion that we can't afford things is just somewhat ludicrous. We're a wealthier country. It's just that it's not evenly distributed or more equally distributed. And the most important problem that we face in the future, things like health care, reducing inequality by improving the education system, these are very complex and difficult problems that need adults.
So too much romanticization
too much adolescence,
of the,
adolescence. With, and one aside, by the way,
with
Chris,
the
book that Kennedy read on Churchill's World War II, it was not World War
One. No, it's World War One. He read it when he was 14 years old. It was called The World Crisis.
Before World War II.
That's what he read. He read it in high school. Let me tell the facts here. I don't think I romanticized Kennedy. I think those who have read the book understand that I've admitted his flaws, but realized that there was a strength there and a leadership there that had to do with sort of basic understanding of how to lead. And I think he was very good on education. In fact, he really made the case for national aid to education, even at the expense of Catholic schools, where he said no aid to Catholic schools. So he was remarkable in many ways, and I think exemplary, and I will stick to my guns on that one, sir.
Chris Matthews, host of Hardball on MSNBC. His new book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Chris, we really appreciate your time.
It's been an honor to be on, Brian. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, we have James Fallows from The Atlantic on the disturbing but remarkable in its way confrontation between police and Occupy protesters at UC Davis the other day. Stay tuned.